I was half not going to come when Jock invited me, but having heard Andrew saying he liked my book, I thought, well, I'm glad I came. The book is old now. It was published in 1981, and it's called Migrant Crime in Australia, and it has a whole array of sets of data and a whole array of possible theories you can use to explain migrant crime. And it was interesting doing it because it started off as a series of papers. I never intended to write a book, but it came as a set of papers, and a friend said one day, when is your book coming out? And I said, I haven't written one. He said, if you look at your papers, you have. And I was working in Sydney at the time, and we did quite a lot of work. One of them was to started off with the historical stuff of when Australia was a penal colony. I got into the Mitchell archives, and there was some very interesting material. And they had things like the original logbooks from the sailing ships with how many criminals were transported. It was wonderful stuff. When I was doing some work, I latched onto it. You may remember the colourful Al Grasby when he was minister. He was very helpful. And I think it was helpful because I found that basically there was a fairly low rate of immigrant crime. And I started to worry about the definitions of why we're dealing with immigrant crime. Is it racism? Is it ethnicism? Is it socioeconomic status? Is it any of those things? And the best answer we can get is birthplace is the one clear thing that's collected in the institutionalist position, that the Australian Bureau of Statistics didn't used to collect birthplace in relation to crime, but they started doing it a few years ago. And prisons are dwelling places, and they list birthplace. Ideally, what I would have liked was the birthplace of the offender, the birthplace of the mother, and the birthplace of the father, so you can look for congruence. But that's pretty hard to catch. So I thought I'd start looking at the various levels of the judicial process, like the police and the courts and the prisons, to see what I could do. And I managed to get into the New South Wales Police. They had a lot of books. They big ledgers, and they open them. They've got the whole set of the name and the offence and the age and where they were born, and so they used to have all this. In fact, one of my favourite ones, going through the books, I saw one of the offences was drunk in a pubic place. Believe it or not. I don't think they meant that. But I collected samples of the data. But what I was interested in doing, to see if there's a congruence between the different stages of the judicial process. And the first one was the police, and you get an idea of what's going on. The second one was to try and get information from the magistrates' courts. But by the time you get matching cases, you'd have to see thousands and thousands and thousands of cases. So what we did is we got the National Film School in Sydney to film two cases, and they were identical except one was overseas born and the other wasn't. And we got into the magistrates' conference, and we got 90% of the magistrates in New South Wales, and we did this very clever experimental design. And then I was working with a colleague, Ian Coyle. And what we did was we gave them the talk, collected the information, and then I carried on talking about the talk, and my friend went away and analysed the data, and we came back and told the magistrates all in the same conference. And that worked well. And it turns out there was no difference. The magistrates did not discriminate on terms of whether they were an immigrant or not. So, in fact, we just made some more in Victoria, and we're in the process of developing the same process to try it in Victoria again, because I'm interested in state-by-state comparisons. But it takes forever to do those things. Another of the things that we did in the prisons data, I had original ABS data. There was no data originally, and we got a Criminology Research Council grant to try and collect information about birthplace in all prisons in Australia on a census night. And I had to go around and try and talk the governors of prisons into doing it, and they were all quite happy to do it. But the response rate was differential. But what was very interesting, I found, is they said, what are you doing? And I explained what I was doing. And I said to the governor, what do you think is going to happen when we've got the information? What do you believe the outcome will be? And they all told me what they believed, and they were all spot on. They've got decades of experience to draw on. And I thought that was a very interesting way of doing it. You go to the experts who draw on decades of experience. They just know. Other things we've done is, the only place I could do it at the time was in Western Australia. And I looked at people who were born overseas in prison for a particular year, everyone, and then to see if they'd ever been in a mental institution. And in that same year, people who had been in a mental institution to see if they'd ever been in prison. And there was a huge overlap. So I asked some of my forensic psychology colleagues, and they say a lot of the cases they see, there are mental health problems in relation to crime. We haven't got any incidents for it, any numbers, but certainly there was a relationship. Ideally, of course, what you'd have is the same for the Australian born. Another thing we tried, this is an introduction to Al Grasby, to the relevant person. I was interested in, if an immigrant who's not a citizen commits an offence that collects a prison sentence of a year or more, is liable to deportation. So that would be nice to see who these people are. The information comes from the States, and I was told in Canberra that it went into the Prime Minister's archives. So I said, can you give it to me? They said, no, it belongs to the States. I said, well, can I have it from the Prime Minister's archives? And they said, no, you can't, because Prime Minister's archives are private. You can't have them. So being a bit creative, I said to the man who was monitoring, I said, there's a point where it goes from the States into the Prime Minister's archives. And he said, yes. Which desk did it come across? He said, this one. I said, so it belongs to you for a minute? And he said, yes. So I said, how about we do a deal? I'm not interested in the people, but you simply record the information I want. And I will pay someone to do that, and I will write you a report. And they said, okay. And I put that one in the book. But that was a nice way of doing it. It's a bit like I wanted some information from the police. And you may remember the commissioner in New South Wales is a man called Allen. And I wrote very respectfully, would you be kind enough to give me the information? And I got a very snotty letter back saying, mind your own business, I'm not going to do it. So I wrote another courteous letter, I think this is important information, it's part of a bigger project, and so on. And I got the same kind of response. And I was lamenting this to one of my graduate students, and she said, I think we can fix that. I know a man who's in the shadow opposition in New South Wales Parliament. Tell me your question. So I gave her the question, and the parliamentarian put it on notice, and the commissioner had to answer it with all the numbers, and I picked them out of Hansard. So I didn't even have to go to the Ethics Committee, which is it's a public document. But you have to be very creative in the way you're doing these things. Oh, yeah, I was interested in some of the cases that have come up. You may remember the Cornelia Rau case. And she was a German-born, but in fact was an Australian resident. And she was mentally ill. And she kept talking in German and so on. And people thought she was an illegal immigrant, and she was actually incarcerated and put into solitary confinement. And there was a big hoo-ha about it, and eventually the thing was solved. And there was another one, I think it was a man called Nystrom, whose mother happened to be in Sweden. The fellow spent the first 27 days of his life in Sweden, so he was Swedish. And then all the rest of the time he spent in Australia, he couldn't speak Swedish. And he committed an offence. And he was liable to deportation, and the minister said, you're going to be deported. And it eventually went to the High Court, and the High Court upheld the minister and actually deported the man. And the CEVs, the suspected illegal entry vessels, there are all sorts of, there are kinds of offences where there are offences related to the being immigrants, like illegal entry and so on, and offences which are common ones, like theft and murder and so on. I find it very hard to disentangle all these things. Another problem that we've encountered is a language problem. I remember talking to a colleague in Melbourne. She was a graduate here, and she came from Latvia when she was four. And her mother spoke to her in Latvian. And she thought in Latvian, and she was educated in English. I said, well, what's it like having two languages? And she thought about it for a while, and she said, it's very interesting. If someone says something emotional to me, I think Latvian. If someone gives me an intellectual idea, I think English. I said, what do you dream in? She said, if it's very emotional, I dream in Latvian, but mostly I dream in English and in colour. Well, I thought that was interesting. But the language can give... There's a famous story, you've probably heard it, of an Italian-born person who was... they got into some altercation with the police. And finally, the Italian was overwhelmed by it, and he said, "Enough, enough," in Italian, "basta, basta." And the policeman thought he was saying bastard and arrested him. But it also took possibilities for misunderstandings. We see this constantly. I've done work as an expert witness in court, and you can see the interpreters standing there. Sometimes the interpreters in the cases, you can see them saying, they start to become advocates, and they'll listen and they'll get the story, and then they'll answer the questions. And the barrister will say something to the defendant, and the interpreter will answer as though the interpreter is the person. And sometimes you get them so they don't know what's going on, because they say, "I speak Polish, but this is a particular dialect. It's way north of Warsaw. I don't speak like that. I don't understand it." So you get problems of misunderstandings of words, misunderstandings of concepts. We did some work a few years ago looking at visual space and personal space around people. And we noticed that people from the Arabian Peninsula, they stand a lot closer than Anglo-Saxons do, and they stand at a slight angle. And sometimes, if this is another person, they get very close and you move back, and finally you find yourself up against a wall because they're invading your personal space. And I think that gives rise to misunderstandings too, simply that the way they behave is different. Oh yes, there's a... New South Wales had a very famous case, you may remember, a social security fraud, which I think it was the longest running committal proceedings with the most number of defendants ever. And it was in 1978, and it was social security fraud. I think there were 150 something defendants. And you find it on the web, and it goes on and on of what happened, and there were some GPs in it that were giving them certificates, and they were claiming things like, "It's your turn to have an accident today and get compensation," and we'll spread it around the family, and all those sorts of stories. And the thing trailed on. I think the only people who ever made any money out of it eventually were the lawyers. But it went on for a very, very long time. Yeah, and another problem we have with the official data is the prospect of trying to get into enclaves. There's a place at Parramatta, I believe, in Sydney, is also being called Vietnamatta. And we have a place in Melbourne, at Richmond, where I go to work on the tram. You drive through it for about, it must be more than a kilometre, it is all Vietnamese, and all the signs are in Vietnamese. You don't see anything in English. And you think, are there problems in these areas? Because if the whole thing is hidden delinquency, you don't know what goes on in the enclaves. It may be that they contain the problems, maybe they don't. Maybe they generate problems. When I start, I'm writing another book at the moment, I'm trying to update it, the old one's getting very dated now. And I've been collecting data. I've got some Australian Bureau of Statistics data, their specially commissioned tables, which I only got this week. And I'm going to analyse those. But each time I start to think about this problem, it seems to me it comes back to what's the issue of policy that the government is engaged in. Because it's part of the bigger issue of population policy. And if you worry about things like we're short of housing, someone very rightly said, "We're not short of houses, we've got a surplus of people." Part of what happens with Melbourne, our dams in Melbourne are now 34%, and they've just relaxed the rules of the way you can use water. And that, to me, is just bizarre. But, so you've got all these problems of what happens with the population policy, of which migration is one, of which the crime of migrants is a part of that. But the policy is a really difficult one. And I've been trying to get in to see the Minister, Chris Evans. And each time I try, I've been given the runaround. "I'm sorry, the Minister's busy," and so on. But I'm a very persistent person, and I've got my MP on side, who is a Deputy Speaker of the Lower House, and I'm sure I'll get in eventually. And I don't know what I'll get from them, but I hope to get something from them. But my questions are going to be ones about policy. What is the policy? What is the population policy? Will it be an urbanisation policy? Will they have satellite cities policy as a different, with fast trains in between? We used to have a scheme here, you may remember. It was the post-war migration scheme. And the scheme was people were at the dispossessed were allowed in from Europe. And when they came in, they had to go where they were told for 2 years. And some of them were stateless people, which must be the most unspeakable thing. An idea of the nation state is fairly recent. But not to have a nation must be unspeakably awful. And they were just so pleased to be here. And they were quite happy. In fact, they built the whole snowy mountain scheme the biggest civil engineering project in Australia ever. And the crime rate was very low. And as a result of that, Mr. Justice Dovey, otherwise famous as Gough Whitlam's father-in-law, wrote three reports. They call the Dovey Reports. And they talk about the policy, the migration policy, and what happens to people and where the crime rates are and so on. They're lovely documents. They're in the National Library in Canberra. And what these documents did, what we don't do now, is have a very, very clear policy. It seems to be ad hoc, on the run, responding to issues, rather than having a clearly articulated policy of what's the maximum number of people Australia can support, how will they be distributed, will you have a particular exclusion policy. And there's one at the moment from last week. It's called the profiling, they profile particular nations. A bit like the first time I went to the United States, they said, do you intend to overthrow the American government by force? And I felt like saying, yes, of course, that's what I came for. But of course, what will profilers do? Will they claim they come from a country that's being profiled? Of course they won't. Now, do we have such a policy? No, we don't have such a policy. We've got pieces of policy, but no overall wholly articulated one. And it seems to me that the policy issues are the critical bits, of which the crime pieces are just a little bit. And the crime pieces are bits that relate to them being migrants, and the crime that relates to them being ordinary, decent criminals, as we might say, they commit ordinary offences like burglary and homicide and so on. And all this seems to come back onto the way that people view them. I used to think originally it was racism, but I think it's much more ethnism than racism. It's the way people perceive the different cultures and the kind of things that we've now banned, like the sexual mutilation of baby girls, for instance, is now banned. Don't care what the culture is. I don't believe all cultures are equal. Some cultures have precepts which are much more in accordance with the UN 1948 Declaration of Human Rights. And it's from that point of view that I'm moving on to the next piece of work that I'm doing.